Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So listen, how's your Christmas shopping going? You haven't started yet, have you? Well, fear not, the big interview is here to help solve all your problems. For the football fans in your life, here's three stocking fillers. Firstly, the documentary film of my book, Barca, The Making of the Greatest Team in the World, is now available everywhere on DVD and digital download. Take the Ball, Pass the Ball is the definitive story, we like to say, of the greatest football team ever assembled, and features exclusive interviews with Barca's stellar cast of current and ex-players, including that geezer Lionel Messi, Xavi, Andres Iniesta, Thierry Henry, Dani Alves, Gerard Piqué, Carlos Puyol and Sergio Busquets, plus a rare exclusive contribution from Pep Guardiola himself. There, that's that one present sorted. Secondly, my old chum and fellow dandy, Jonathan Northcroft, has a new book out published by Backpage, these marvellous people that bring you the books, the podcasts. It's called Deadlines and Darts with Delhi, and it's Jonathan's World Cup diary from Russia last summer, and it's essential reading for the football fan in your life. Finally, check out another Backpage book, Football 2.0, How the World's Best Play the Modern Game by Grant Wall. Through extensive interviews with one player in every key position on and off the pitch, Grant breaks down the technical and tactical revolutions which have transformed football. So, there you have it. Take the Ball, Pass the Ball, Deadlines and Darts with Delhi, Football 2.0. That's not only difficult to say, it's Christmas sorted. Courtesy of your friends at the big interview. You're ho, ho, ho. Welcome. You're about to listen to an interview which our socios enjoyed in full 12 months ago. If you'd like to listen to these exclusive monthly big interviews on the day that they're released, it's time to join us. That means supporting us. It means the price of a pint per month. Go to Patreon, patreon.com/Graham Hunter. Go now, join and become a socio. That means you'll get that extra big interview every month and you'll also unlock our entire archive straight away. All for £2.99 a month. It's the best deal in town, baby. And we need you. It is time for a new big interview. It's Super Kevin Phillips, Sunderland legend, and the winner of something called the Golden Shoe. Well, to hell with that, the Golden Boot. Kevin once outscored every top striker in Europe. I was thrilled to listen to him describe his thought process in front of goal, plus his explanation of the art of finishing, which includes a wonderful quote from the great Jimmy Greaves. Our guest takes us back to his younger days playing right back, yes, you heard me correctly, at non-league Baldock Town, an unforgiving, dangerous environment. I had huge fun recording this podcast. Keep listening and you'll find out why. The big interview is very privileged today because right now, as we speak, it's the middle of the British summer, so it's raining, and I've got my usual beautiful black leather kind of moccasin style shoes on, and there's a hole in them and it's letting in water. But we're sitting talking to the only English Golden Boot winner, European Golden Boot, the English equivalent of Gert Muller or Ronaldo. But Kevin Phillips, your starter for tenure, at least my question to begin today is this. I've read an interview with you where you're up Baldock Town and Ian Allanson phones you up, phones his right back up, let's say, to let him know that, and it's you, that they're short of a striker. And the quotes that are attributed to you were, well, yeah, I used to play there and maybe I should. And I... Now, in my life in football, I've met goalies who think they're strikers. Every groundsman thinks he's a striker. But your quotes kind of go like, oh, yeah, I used to play there. Maybe I could, and up front you go. When you get that phone call back at Baldock Town and you've been playing as a right back and he kind of says, we need a striker, is it true that you hadn't been kind of at him, Ian Allanson, in training all the time saying, boss, I am a striker, let me play up front, will you?
It is true. And, you know, it could easily, someone sitting there listening now will probably think, nah, that's been made up. But I swear to, you know, I'm totally honest. You ask Ian himself, that was the conversation we had. The phone rang out the blue Friday night, and believe it or not, I stayed in. Friday night before a non-league game. So I was disciplined, I was dedicated enough because I always felt I would get a second opportunity at turning professional. So, yeah, the phone rang, but I'd kind of got it in my head that I played 2 years as right back at Southampton as apprentice. I went there as a striker. The classic, I got told I was too small. The only position that we had for you was a fullback. So it was a chance to play, and I ended up playing there for 2 years, got released, went into non-league, and I kind of forgot about being a striker, if I was being totally honest. Started playing fullback in men's football, which was very difficult. I had to jump from being a boy to a man, and I had to adapt really quickly. So you're right, you know, the phone went on a Friday night, and the gaffer rings, and he says, Kev, you know, a bit of a bizarre, funny question. He says, have you ever played up front? And I went, well, funny you should say that. I've always been a striker. I said, I haven't really pestered you with it, because I've done it for 2 years as an apprentice. I've done it for a short spell here at Baldock. So it's kind of, you know, gone to the back of my mind. But I am a striker. He said, well, we're struggling for one tomorrow. And do you fancy having a go? I went, of course. And it was Burnham away. And we won the game and I scored 2 goals and never looked back.
Well, excuse me for being pedantic, but, like, for example, let's work out what that phone call's like. When he's phoned you up, has he either seen something from you in training you never told him up yourself, or are you the 8th phone call? Because if you haven't been knocking on his door and saying, boss, I'm a striker, and we're playing right back in training for Baldock, why has he phoned you?
Because I think probably watching me in games and in training, I was like a wing back, and I didn't want to defend. I weren't a great defender, and I was always trying to get in the box, and the amount of times he'd have a go at me about what you're doing up there. So perhaps he saw something in me that this lad wants to try and score goals. Whenever we had little small-sided games in training, I was forever trying to get on the ball, get in the box and score goals. So he's obviously seen something. He actually is a friend of the family. So maybe someone within my family got into him saying, look, he can play up front, he is a goal scorer. Scored lots of goals as a young kid in the Stevenage League where Ian grew up. So perhaps he heard, you know, speaking to one of my family members. But I never really once said to him, look, boss, can I play up front?
You know the phenomenon I'm talking about, though, for everybody thinks he's a striker. I remember, like, interviewing Sergio Busquets, who's now your archetypical brain of the midfield. Yeah. Right position, right touch, you know, choices all the time. Positionally so clever. He said, I wish to hell I wasn't this. He said, the only thing that's beautiful about football is scoring goals. And he used to be a striker. Even Puyol at one stage thought, when he wasn't allowed to be a goalkeeper anymore because he was banging his head in the concrete ground at the playground anymore, and the doctor said to him, no more of that. He wanted to be a striker. Right. Wherever you go, everybody thinks they're a striker. And you kept, this is what fascinates me, you kept the total belief about, I'm not finished with the professional game, but you parked away that little thing that you'd always wanted to do. That's a slightly strange combination of choices, do you know what I mean?
Oh, definitely. And, you know, it's a big part of it is the 2 years as an apprentice at Southampton, working under Dave Merrington. When he said to me, listen, lad, at the moment you're too small to be a centre-forward in our team. Yes, technically you're good. We see you better coming onto the game than with your back to play, which I kind of agreed at the time. So I went along with it. But yeah, there was always that bit in the back of my mind. I parked it to the back of my brain, but there was always that bit there that wanted to come out and get up front. And even the 2 years as an apprentice, I used to try and make overlap over overlap, getting in at the back stick when the ball was going down the left-hand side. And as I said, you know, defending, I wasn't very good. But I always had that belief, one day I would get a crack at being a centre-forward. And believe me, when that phone call came on that Friday night, if it hadn't have come, you know, I perhaps maybe would never, you know, wouldn't be sitting here now doing an interview with
wouldn't
you.
Wouldn't be the only English winner of the Golden Boot.
Yes.
I'm a romantic, a pure-born romantic, now therefore allow me my flights of fancy. Were you answering the phone to somebody you'd cheered on when he was an Arsenal boy, keeping Charlie Nicholas out of the team?
Yeah.
Beating Spurs in the semi-final of the league.
Yeah.
He was an Arsenal man and you were an Arsenal man, no?
Yes, I was. I used to watch Ian from the stands and it was quite surreal. It was my mum that got me into Baldock Town at the time, and when I realised Ian Allison was the manager, I would have walked there. It was a good 10-15 mile away from the home, but I would have ran there just to meet him and secondly try and play for him. So, yeah, I grew up as a young lad and it was my sister's first boyfriend that used to take me to Highbury. We used to get the train from Stevenage to Finsbury, the little walk from Finsbury Park to Highbury. And it
then
was
just
brilliant.
Stop at Finsbury Park and walk us to Highbury. Because we've done this with Charlie Nick once.
Right, yeah.
I don't want to spoil your story, but, I mean, what a temple. When you turn the corner. So take us through Finsbury Park by foot.
Well, don't forget, I was a young boy then, so it was quite daunting and it was quite scary.
Yeah.
The crowd. Yeah, I hadn't been used to that. You know, I hadn't been used to it, and it was one of the first times I'd been to a game on a train. It wasn't a long journey from Stevenage to Finsbury Park, it's only a half hour, but the train, as soon as you got to Stevenage, you know, there's tons of Arsenal supporters from Stevenage. You're crammed on the train, the singing starting, and I'm a young lad, and you're trying to take it all in. You're kind of hoping that you don't get caught up in any trouble. But the people I were with were quite sensible, and, you know, as soon as you get off that train at Finsbury Park, you go down the steps and you come out, there's Arsenal supporters everywhere. It's almost like a little pub crawl to the stadium.
Yeah.
And I remember this pub we always used to go in. I wasn't drinking, you know, I'd have a Coke or something. And I think it was called the Black Ball or something like that. But it was a big Arsenal pub. And it was crazy in there. It was absolutely crazy. But it was fantastic memories. And
As you get closer, all I remember when I used to go to Highbury was you could start to smell. People's gardens are rented out and you can smell the onions and
cooking,
the burgers and the hot dogs.
The atmosphere is like a carnival atmosphere.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic. You know, the singing, the closer you got to the ground, you hear the singing, you heard the noise from inside the stadium. And then when you come around that corner and you see Highbury, you know, it's just tucked away, isn't it, in a housing estate. But it was fantastic. And I couldn't wait to get through the turnstiles. And I always remember, you know, the first time I went there, the turnstiles, you can't see the pitch. You go up the steps and all of a sudden it's there and you think...
Green has never looked so beautiful, has it?
It was amazing.
It seems to glow a little bit, doesn't it?
And then straight away the adrenaline within you goes, I'd love to be out there.
Yeah.
I'd absolutely love to be out there. Yeah, my first time, you know, was watching Ian Allison.
So that is a point. I mean, not minute by minute of games because they must have gone by now.
But
impressions first, or that team.
It was Paul Davis, Rocky Rowcastle, that sort of era. David O'Leary,
George Graham.
Yeah. So it was, you know, there were some good players. I didn't go every week. You know, I'm not saying I'm an avid Arsenal fan and I went week in and week out. But when I could go, I'd go. We'd sit in the clock end. We'll stand in the clock end then.
The players that might have caught your eye especially that you liked, either for or against?
Now you're testing me. Probably Paul Davis and Rocky Rowcastle were two fantastic players for me at the time. Although, you know, they weren't centre-forwards.
Did Paul Davis have something of Vieira about him?
Yeah. He just glided with the ball. He always looked comfortable on the ball. He always was in an area or in space to be able to receive the football. And when he did receive it with someone on him, he managed to wriggle out of it and get out of the situation. You know, Alan Smith playing, you know, as well, who...
Really underestimated as a footballer.
Yeah, he's a fantastic footballer.
Yeah.
Great at what he did. You know, Big Quinny almost, you know, was on the scene, but a young lad.
Yeah.
It was, you know, later on, so...
I sense you've dug him up about that. Like, I used to watch you and I just hear dressing room humour there, for sure.
Yeah, but, when I started playing for Sunderland and played with Quinny, you know, forever asking him questions about his Arsenal days, and he had some fantastic stories, which a lot of them you can't print, about certain players that he played with. But it was just great to pick his brains about that era that he... You know, I used to go and watch, and he was involved in that, you know, in that era, you know, late on in it. Still with the players that I kind of grew up watching, and you know, it was great, fascinating to hear what
Janeiro, he was saying. Massive characters. Oh. Apart from the ability you had to play, and I said that about Alan Smith, but for example, in that era, maybe a little bit after Steve Bould, David Louis, both of them, I think, under, because it became so established about, you know, Dixon and Winterburn, Big Tony and Keown, I think both Bould and O'Leary were forgotten about in terms of how good they were, but you had to hold your own in the training ground, in the dressing room with George. It was a tough school.
I'm sure of it. And I was fortunate enough to play with big Stevie Bold as well towards the end of his
career. Football, right?
Great footballer. Even then, you know, he was touching 40 when he come to us, and you could still, he had quality. Legs weren't as great as what they were when he was younger. But yeah, he was an intelligent guy. Managed to work under David O'Leary, so be able to pick his brains about the Arsenal days. So although I wasn't involved in it, actually watching it from afar, picking up stories off of Niall and Steve, you know, it was a great learning curve about, you're right, having to hold your own amongst those them sort of players.
So you did that. We talked about the phone call from Ian Allinson, who scored in that season that they won the League Cup. When you're at Bollock Town and you've been told that probably, well, certainly the first professional club that you get terms with says to you, no thanks, you're well known for saying, I knew that an opportunity might come around, and you're clearly here because you worked at it and it did. But why did you think that? When did the belief waver?
I think I always had that belief. You know, if I'm being dark, you know, even now, I've been retired 4 years, there's still a part of me believes that if I really wanted to, I could come out of retirement and play again. Now, that might be a daft thing to say, but I still believe that I can do it. Now, I suppose you speak to many footballers that perhaps say, I still feel I can do it here, but this won't allow you to do it. But I've always had it in my brain that, you know, I was never, ever going to give up. I had fantastic support from my parents. My dad wrote to every football club in the country when I was released as an 18-year-old boy. And even then, you know, we got two replies. That's all we got from every club in the country.
You can't remember who?
One of them was Charlton and one was Millwall, believe it or not. Two, you know, South London clubs. Just saying, unfortunately, we've got our full quota of players and we'll keep your name on the record.
See, people now exist via emails. And that process of actually somebody writing to every club, finding the address, getting out the post office, sending them off, that say goodbye to the letter, and it's like sending a son off to war. You may never hear or see from that. You don't even know that the letter's got there. So we are watching that process. That must do something to a kid who goes, geez, look what my old man's doing for me, no?
Well, I'll tell you know, what he did as well. Every day when that post box opened or the letter box opened in the house, I was praying and hoping it was a reply from one of the clubs. And I remember, you know, the first time I did get the reply, the letter drops on the floor and it's actually got the Millwall and the Charlton crest on it. So straight away, I'm thinking, I'm getting a trial. Open it up, you know, two knockbacks. And a part of me was, of course, gutted. But I still had that belief to go and try and perform for Bollock Town in that right-back slot at the time, and hopefully someone will see something in me and give me an opportunity. So I never gave up. And what I said to you earlier about when I answered that phone call on a Friday night, you know, there was many times when my friends were knocking for me saying, listen, your football career's over. You know, you've got to forget it. You've got to let it go. Come out with the lads Friday night. We're having a good time. You're missing out on this. And I'm like, no, I'm not coming out. I've got a game tomorrow and I still believe I'm going to get an opportunity. So if I hadn't have been strong enough, and if I hadn't have had strong parents as well, I certainly would have been out every Friday, probably played crap on a Saturday and never ever got me.
And at the time, you'd have enjoyed the hell out of it. You wouldn't have known the opportunity really was slipping by and that everything you believed in really was there. But I know a lot of professional footballers thought like that too. Even as a professional, that you could probably be out, say, two nights before a game, and if you were fit or you trained really well, you could live like that. And that was you at Bollock Town saying, no, I'm not going to live like that.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I remember doing it a couple of times, and Ian Allinson saw straight through
me. He noticed.
Said, oh, God, yeah, without a shadow of doubt. Being an ex-pro as well, you know, you could tell. You maybe would have got away with it, someone that hadn't played the game, perhaps didn't know as much, but he knew straight away, and I took a couple of bollockings off him, you know, for doing it. And it didn't happen very often, but once, you know, he gave me those couple, I never ever did it again. And, you know, I could quite easily have done it. I'm an 18, 19-year-old kid, you know, that wants to live his life, but I had to sacrifice a little bit for my future.
In this series, one of the people that we admired very much indeed and had a joyous morning with was Chris Waddle. And Chris had a similar experience where at a certain stage he was told it wasn't happening for him, timing, he was very skinny and I mean, obviously gifted, went, I think, worked in a meat factory or chicken factory, but played in non-league football. Now, he was different from you in that he was on the ball attacking all the time in non-league, and therefore, what he taught us a lot about was dealing with intimidation, both the physical side and the mental side, still wanting the ball, maybe in sometimes, in Chris's cases, humiliating the guy. even though you were overlapping a right back, you were facing presumably bigger, older guys who probably were giving you the same evil intention about get out of my way or don't tackle me or whatever. What was the good and the bad and the ugly of being a right back at 18? Yeah, from 18 to 22? Yeah,
from 18 to 21.
Physically at 18, what are you like compared now? Because you're still, strong now.
Yeah, well, I was very slight and, I've bulked up, I had to work on that. So I wasn't physically very strong, but I was quick. I could get out of the way, I could ride challenges. I'd rather try and nick the ball off someone than go crashing in a 50-50 because I'd probably get hurt.
Yeah.
So I had to try and work on the timing of my tackling, just be careful who I picked on or went up against. And I had to become a little bit more clever.
They call that savvy, don't they?
Yeah, a bit streetwise. And, I had to try and adjust my game a little bit.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
First of all, can we clear something up? We're new friends, but that's a golden shoe. in all seriousness, it's a golden boot, isn't it?
It's a golden boot.
When you get that in your hands, that time, that stage, you're the first Englishman to do it. You're still preceded by Jardel, subsequently Larson, two pretty good strikers.
Yeah.
What degree of Baldock Town is in that moment? What degree of Ian Allanson is in that moment?
Oh, everything. I think, everything. My parents, who unfortunately I lost when they were very young and I was very young. I was only 20 when they both passed away. And there was a point in my career when that happened. I'd just turned professional at Watford under Glenn Rooder. And I only ever wanted my dad to see me play professional football.
Yeah.
And when he passed away, I thought, well, I've played 6 months as a pro. That's it. It hurt me that much. I didn't want to carry on.
Man.
So Glenn Rooder was fantastic in helping me deal with the situation. And so was Ian Allanson, actually. He spoke to me quite often on the phone.
That's fabulous to know, because I don't think it's unfair to say that in football you can find a lot of people who maybe aren't bad, but they are quite selfish. That when you can say that about Glenn, who's somebody who coincidentally helped me a lot when I came down new to England, and say again about Ian, if you're talking about being that devastated about the loss of parents and maybe giving up a professional career, to identify that they knew you well enough and cared enough to invest time in helping you through.
Yeah.
That's pretty special.
Glenn will always have a special place in my heart. And ultimately, I owe everything to Glenn Rooder, because he's the one that signed me from non-league to give me that opportunity for Watford. And, whenever I get a chance to speak to him now, it's great to see him. And, he's had his troubles as well in his time with his health. But you're right. When I did get presented with that golden boot, when I had a chance to sit down and really reflect and take on board, you think about those cold Tuesday nights training on a crap pitch at Baldock Town. Ian Allanson trying to help me, give me guidance, Glenn Rooder, Dad travelling here, there and everywhere, taking me all over the country. So all them things do go through your mind, and they all play a massive part in me winning that boot.
I remember, without being too maudlin, that I'd met Frank Lampard's parents and his mum just before she died. She died too young too, and I remember speaking to him in Germany, in Munich, when Chelsea won the Champions League, and we had a little interview in the dressing room afterwards, and I felt it was okay to ask him, did he feel connected? Did he feel that maybe she was looking over it in some way? And he was really clear that yes. And I think that's a good emotion to have.
Yeah.
Do you ever think about Can he see? Does he know? Does the energy off your career?
It did, yeah. Early on, you know, soon the first few years, you know, and he passed away. Yeah, of course. I always thought about it when you had that, you know, you did your lineup, you came out, and I always looked to the sky. But as time went on, you know, it's a great healer. You don't never forget, but, you know, you kind of forget about it once the emotion and the adrenaline. You know, I always think about it when we have minute silence for someone who's passed away. You know, I'm thinking about that person, but also, you know, it brings it straight back to you, which it always will do. Yeah, always.
I like and respect and appreciate that. So when the boot comes to you, what happens? I hope it comes in a fleet of Rolls Royces and they sort of cordon off the neighbourhood and, you know, there's beautiful models to bring it. Tell me it didn't arrive, make your own home boot in the post.
I did get invited to a meal in, I think it was Switzerland, but we were playing on the Tuesday night. It was on a Tuesday night, and it would have been with all the players that have won it. And I was gutted I couldn't go, because to sit with the people that you just mentioned that have won the European Golden Boot would have been amazing.
Yeah.
But we had a game on that night. They brought the shoe. Oh, well, the shonk shoe, calling it the shoe. No? They brought the boot to me, and they presented to me before the game at Stadium Alight in front of a packed crowd. And I have to say, you know, as much as it is for me the biggest honour that I've achieved as a player, playing for my country, I thought they could have done something a little bit better.
Well, I would say it's typical of the football authorities.
Yeah.
It's your year.
Yeah.
So, like, we're planning a dinner. Let's see if he's playing.
No,
we've got the lamb in. We've got the lamb and the red wine in. Yeah, we can't change it. Yeah. He's only playing. You know?
So, yeah, I was a bit, you know, considering, you know, I've won it at a club, no disrespect to some of the players that have won it before, is Barcelona's
your
Madrid.
That's what makes it more exciting.
Yeah.
Not only are they the only Englishman to do it, you win it at Sunderland. It's absolutely exceptional. There'll be Sunderland fans who'll go in discussions like we just had here at the club, like, but do you remember the night when Kim Phillips brought the golden, you know?
Yeah, it wasn't.
It's brilliant. It's not to be talked down because it's Sunderland. I think it's fantastic. Yeah.
No, it was fantastic. And believe me, it sits on the mantelpiece now. Pride of joy.
Is it heavy?
It is heavy, yeah. It's very heavy. I won the Premier League Golden Boot that season as well. And they're pretty similar, but the European one does seem a little bit
heavier. Do you ever put it up against your foot? Is it the right size? Because they should measure you. It should be your foot.
Yeah, I wish. I'm real gold, of course.
Hold on.
I wish.
Whoa. It's not.
No, it's not real gold.
Are you going to tell me something I don't know about Father Christmas as well now? This is a bad day at Black Rock.
No, it's not real gold.
All right, so you win that, and before I move on, there's another little moment, I think, that comes. It's not the same as the Golden Boot season, I think it's the season before, where you're the first since 1961-62 at Sunderland to score 30 goals.
And 35.
And Cloughy, who I think too many people probably forget that he was a Sunderland striker before
his big injury. Well, I broke his record.
What's the occasion like? What happens? And had you met Cloughy before?
Yeah,
that?
I did. The great man presented me with a shirt before a game at the Stadium Alight, and he came onto the pitch, and it was a massive honour for me. Everything was coming to me so quick, you know, I was breaking records so quick at Sunderland that I was meeting people left, right and centre that I weren't sure, you know. Obviously I knew Brian Clough because of who he was, but there was other people I was meeting from Sunderland whose record I'd beaten, and I wasn't too sure who they were.
Scoring in a row.
Yeah, 7 in a row, which I got was a new record at Sunderland, and this and that. But yeah, meeting the great man, he presented me with a shirt before a game, and unfortunately for poor Brian, it was at a time when he was struggling with his health.
Already,
was
he?
And, you know, it would have been nice to have met him and had a chat with him, but I never even got time to chat to him. It was just literally shake hands, shirt. And all I remember him doing, I stood next to him. It was before in a game again. They always present me stuff before a game, it seemed to be. And he kept kicking the back of me leg for some reason. I thought, what's he doing? And he just kept nudging the back of me. And every time I looked at me, he would just wink at me. Didn't really say anything to me, just winked at me, and I thought, that's enough for me.
Now we go into the laboratory. This is the bit that you may or may not like, but also it's the time to be truthful, because finishing, scoring. I'll ask you, because not only did you score a lot of goals and you're famous, above and beyond being good player, good technical player, good team player, goals made your career. And if you look at the goals, there's an awful lot of spectacular goals. You really did hit. The very few that I've looked at, and I looked at most of the 250-odd, that weren't pretty or impressive or clever. But one thing stands out for me. You often seem to know about a goalkeeper's, where the weight was planted or positioning. Now, I might be imagining that, so it's a time to tell the truth. Did you just hit it as cleanly as you could and hope that the keeper was? Or because quite often, you're the Jimmy Greaves kind of like, I'm just going to send that one that way.
It's funny you say Jimmy Greaves, because I always remember one of the quotes my dad told me. And he said to me, always remember this. He said, Jimmy Greaves famously said, you'll score more goals by passing the ball in the back of the net than you will by smashing it. And that has always stuck in my brain. And I try to tell our young players now, I try to tell our first team players that now. And when I do look back at the goals, and I quite often do it, you know, I'm not ashamed to say it, it's not being big-headed, but I enjoy sitting down. I've got two young lads now who quite often sit and watch it and just stick it on. And majority of my goals are side-footed, trying to bend it in the corner, trying to pass it into the net. And you're right, you know, I wouldn't say, you know, I spent hours and hours studying the goalkeeper before I played him to see, you know, where his weight was most of the time, you know, where his position was. I just had it in my mind, it's me versus you, I'm going for that corner, and if I hit it right and bend it in the corner, you're not going to save it. And that was my focus, that was my thought process when I went onto the pitch. Of course, there's going to come times where you do want to lash the ball, but not many times I kind of lashed it, even from 25 yards out. I remember my second goal in the Premier League was a 25-yard curler against Watford at the Stadium of Light, where I just dropped my shoulder, give myself half a yard and just bent it in the top corner. There wasn't a lot of power. It was just trying to guide it into the net.
I could have asked you that same question, and many people I've met, and they just wouldn't have had a clue. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I scored lots of goals, I played in lots of games, but what sticks with me is the laughs, or the trophy, or the bonuses, or the money. But I've seen you talking about goals. You've almost got a photographic memory of them.
Every goal, I could tell you, every goal. I have to say that, you know, there's been many goals when I watch it back, and I think the big thing for me, people say, well, why was you in that position? Now, that's one thing I might struggle to answer, because for me, that's instinct. And when I speak to Robbie Fowler, who I spent some days with in the summer, and I picked his brains about it, Michael Owen, I'm sure when you ask those sort of players, well, why did you get in that position? I don't know, I just found myself there. How comes you were in space? I think maybe because you were probably thinking 1 yard ahead or one step ahead of the defender.
There's a question then. When you're thinking a yard ahead, now looking back, what are you thinking about? Are you thinking about when's Mickey Gray going to deliver, or last time I tried to turn that defender, he attacked the ball rather than staying on me? Because that's an expression, the first yard's in his head. When you were doing that, if you think back, what were the things that you were thinking about in that first yard when you were peeling off a defender, going this way and staying onside when he thought he was stepping up? All those things. What were the little points in your head that made you do that thing that suddenly looked just instinctive?
Well, I think one of the biggest things was, first and foremost, don't stand still. Try and always be on the move. Try and never get in the defender's eyesight or his eye line. Try and stay out of his eyesight. So as soon as I always look at the defender, as soon as he looks at you, I feel I've got him. Because as soon as he looks at me, the next thing he's got to do is look back, and then that's when I move. So, you know, it's stuff that I worked on, but it's stuff that, you know, I wouldn't work on every day of the week. You probably spend an hour or so a week doing. But it was anticipation, really, trying to anticipate where that ball's going to land. So if Mickey Gray's going down the left, you know, just try and... I would say, you know, we coach young strikers now about getting across the near post, getting round the back, or getting someone, you know, across the goalkeeper. Yeah, that's great, but talking about that selfishness earlier, I would kind of think, if I run across that near post, I'm not really going to get my opportunity here. I'd rather try and wait till that ball's in mid-flight, and then I'll move,
judge,
instead of going too early. So as soon as it leaves its foot, I believe I had a bit of a knack about it's going in the middle of the goal. I'll get in between the defenders and try and, you know, get my opportunity there.
I'm a big fan of movies. And as you're growing up, there weren't as wide range of movies, but there were lots of Westerns. And the archetypical scene in a Western is boots, hard ground, spurs, an alley or a mid street, you know, it's high noon. White hat, black hat, it's always one-on-one, and who's the fastest? Twice you've said that, but it's me and you to the keeper,
and
it's me and you to the centre-half. Did you make it all into little duels, me and you?
Yeah, definitely. It's me against the two centre-halves, I always felt. You know, forget the full-backs. I was always trying to get the better of the two centre-halves. But don't forget, I played most of my career with another striker. So you'd like to think that the other striker would take care of one in the centre-half. So you're right, most of the time it was me against you. And if you're the right side of centre-half, he's the left side of centre-half, and whoever my strike partner comes across me and I move there, then it's me against you. I've just got to try and get the best of you, and I know I'll get an opportunity.
And is it only movement, or do you niggle away in their heads?
Yeah, of course, yeah. It was all the old... to be fair, I wasn't one that's saying, oh, I'm going to get the best of you today, I'm going to do this. I would kind of like, actions speak louder than words.
A little bump, or stand on the toes?
Well, I remember, I did that once against Jens Lehmann, and I got fined $10,000. so I learned my lesson pretty quick.
God, you must have really pretty toes.
For once, I got told to go on the keeper, which I weren't happy about, because I wanted to find space and try and get me opportunity, but we're playing Arsenal. It was at the Stadium of Light. And Jens was elbowing me, pushing me out of the way. And in the end, I just had enough. And I just stamped on his toes. And the ref saw it. And retrospective, I got done. So I learnt my lesson there. But you're right. You know, a little just lean into a defender. And if you're going to get that half yard, push off them. And try and get them off balance so that you can get in front of them if you are too close to one of the defenders. But I never try to get too close to them.
Yeah.
Because of the physicality, really. I know I was quite low centre of gravity. And I was quite strong. Mm-hmm. But... you know, really physically, a defender should be, you know, winning a duel against myself. So I never really got tried to get too close to him. I tried to always stay away and try him in behind or in front of them.
So another thing I do is I love it when England's new bowlers get an AMLA out all the time, every time he's in his head. Were the defenders where you're putting on your boots and your shin guards before a match and going, yeah, I know I've got this guy?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Toast.
Yeah, definitely. But then flip side of that.
You know, so give us the ball. Yeah. Give us the guy where, oh, you beauty, it's
yeah.
him again.
Oh, yeah, many times.
Give us the guy who, wow, how am I going to get one today?
Well, you know, in terms of players that I always fancied going up against were players that perhaps weren't so mobile. You know, 10, 15 years ago, players weren't athletically as mobile as perhaps, definitely. What they are now. So, you know, my game was based on being sharp, nippy. So I always felt, you know, he's not the quickest, this guy. So if I can get little balls fed down the side, you know, I can hurt this guy. But then you'd come up against players who were pretty quick, you know, late 10 years ago in Rio Ferdinand mm-hmm. and Vidic and people like that. Phew, you knew you had to come up with something a bit different because you couldn't outrun these guys. So you had to try and be a bit more clever than them. But, you know, I found late, you know, as my career went on, even these defenders are getting clever now. Physically, they're mobile, they can run. So, you know, it became more and more difficult. But yeah, you know, you ask any striker. When you look at, when you're analysing the game's coming up Saturday, and you look at who you're playing against, you think, boy, I fancy my chance today, I'm going to get some opportunities.
The psychology of striking is, playing full stop, but striking has always really interested me. Now, I think you told Tim Rich a while ago that at Sunderland you would watch videos of your own goals, maybe day before a game or morning of a game or whatever, just for... reassurance, or how did I?
Yeah, definitely. I used to quite watch it virtually, especially home games. I would sit and put it on in the morning, and just repetition, really, just to see myself hitting the back of the net. Good habits, you know. Just watching it, and you know, we all love watching that. Don't let any player tell you that they don't like watching themselves on TV. We all love it. There's that ego inside of us that loves watching ourselves score goals. I'll give you an example. We're travelling to Sunderland on Thursday afternoon. This Thursday just gone, Sky's on the bus, and the rerun of the playoff final, Palace versus Singh, and I had control of the Sky button. And because I scored the winning goal, I thought, no one's turning this over, so I hit the Sky control, because I knew that my goal was coming out, and we all love watching ourselves. Yeah. So I used to stick it on, and he just used to do something inside me, and it gave me a buzz. As soon as I turned up at that stadium, you know, I can remember, it's fresh in my brain, and I'm ready to go.
It's like when they talk about golf or muscle memory, where if you do the right thing over and over again, you'll begin to do it automatically. That sort of idea.
Yeah, definitely.
Who suggested it to you, or did you just invent it?
I just think I invented it. I was born with it, I think. Well, no one's ever really told me about it. And it's quite, you know, amazing as it seems, I've never really had much coaching in terms of forward play.
Oh.
Yeah, you'd have your... shooting practices, but yep. Never really got pulled to one side.
And the psychology.
Yeah, the psychology. Sat down about this and that, shown videos of strikers, this and that. Never really been pulled to one side to say, look, yeah, they would show us the runs. You know, if one comes short, you've got to run in along the line and in, pulling off and going in, which are all your basic stuff as a centre forward. But no one ever really sat down and tried psychologically, mm-hmm. pick my brains about, you know, what you're thinking. What's your thought process? But obviously nowadays it's happening quite regularly, which I think is right.
Can I throw in something that I really liked, and I hope you like the word, but there was a cheekiness too. You've talked an awful lot about scoring the winner at Newcastle on the occasion and whatever, but if people don't remember it, it's 1-0 them, pouring rain,
yeah.
Hulett's...
1-0, yeah. Hulett, 1-0, Shearer 20. Started on the bench.
Yeah, when you see that team sheet, what do you think?
Oh, straight away we've got an unbelievable opportunity. Big Dunk was on there. The bench as well.
Yeah. Sunderland had gone a long time without winning there, right?
They hadn't won there for a long time.
And you knew there's internal warfare at the club because it's all over the papers. Hullett and Shearer aren't getting on.
Yeah. Well, we found out on the bus on the way to the stadium, and as soon as that news filtered through to the bus, you could sense the difference in atmosphere on the team bus. And I believe we won the game then. So we turned out there was a funny atmosphere within the stadium because them two had been dropped. Hullett, supposedly, if he lost the game, was getting the sack the next day. So it's my first derby, my first taste of it, and it was amazing. The atmosphere, once we got in the stadium, you know, when it got near kickoff, was electric. The weather was horrendous. If it had gone on for another 10 minutes, if it had gone on for another 10 minutes, he would have called it off. When I managed to get that goal, and you could call it a cheeky goal.
For those who don't remember, the ball, you know, you come in, you get a little shot. I think Tommy Wright blocks it, but at that stage, the 6-yard box is quite busy. Tommy Wright's closing down your angle. You don't have a lot of angle. And you're running away from goal. Yeah. If you do the old question of sport thing, what happened next? You don't say goal. And you especially don't say this beautiful flight. It's sort of Shane Warne lob over. So all I'm talking about is the cheekiness to say, that's what to do. And I can put... So take me from the point you're running away from the goal.
Yeah, well, it was. I remember there was a massive challenge in the far right-hand corner. And I think it was on Shearer at the time. So he'd come on. Kevin Ball, I think, crunched Alan Shearer far right, and the ball dropped to Gavin McCann. And because you know your players, I knew Gavin would have one look up and try to feed the ball in behind the back four. So my first thought was, I'm going to move, I'm going to try and run in behind. He put a lovely ball in behind. And as soon as he left his foot, I thought, I'm in here, I'm going to get an opportunity. But as it come to me, and I wanted to hit it first time, it hit a puddle and virtually stopped still.
Okay.
So it stopped in front of me a little bit under my feet, and time I had to look up, Tommy Wright, he's to be fair to him, he was on me. And he was quite a big guy, you know. So I tried to dink it over him, and it's hit him in the midriff and ricocheted off to the left-hand side of their goal, corner of 6-yard box. So I carried on my run round, and I run round the ball, and my thought process was, right, what do I do now?
Yeah.
Part of me's disappointed I've missed a golden opportunity.
Yeah.
So then I had to quickly, you know, digest that, get rid of that thought. Right, what am I going to do now? So
You've got your back to goal. You can't see what's happening behind you.
So I'm running, but I've had a little look straight while I'm running to think, right, what do I do? All I saw, I think, was about 3 or 4 Newcastle players, and I saw Big Niall trying to make to the back stick. And I just thought, now this is where my little bit of selfishness came in, a bit of cheekiness. One of the biggest things at Matt's stage then was my confidence was massive. If I'd have gone into that game not having scored the amount of goals I would have, I probably wouldn't have attempted the chip. But I just thought, I'm going for goal. And I must admit, I hit the sweetest chip that I've ever hit in my whole career. And it just looped. As soon as it left my foot, I just knew it was going in. And it went over the back. I think it was Warren Barton who tried to jump back onto the line and head it. And it went in, and the stadium went silent. Because, you know, St James is the supporters are way in the gods. Yep. And you could hardly hear them. My wife was at the game. Couldn't hear it, but I turned and I skidded on my knees. And I just remember skidding on my knees. I thought, if I don't get or roll over something, I'm going to go straight into the advertising boards here because it was that wet. And before I knew it, all the lads were on me. And it was an amazing feeling. One, to have scored in the derby. Two, to the selfishness to continue my goal-scoring run in the Premier League, proving people wrong, and turned out to be the winner, which was, although I think I'd scored nearly 60 or 70 goals for Sunderland already, still didn't feel that I was part of their folklore until you score in a derby. And I felt from that moment, that was it. Then I really cracked it in the North East.
We've touched on that a couple of times then. There is a huge amount of confidence and mentality. No matter how good a striker you are, that you have to feel I'm in the zone. This is my day. I can pull this off. Otherwise, no matter how good you are, your technique is, something might be missing. Have we hit on that as a fact?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Yeah, that's a huge fact. We all went into that game with a mentality of, we're going to win this game tonight. No matter what happens, no matter about the weather. Yes, we had a little bit of luck with Shearer being on a bench, Duncan Ferguson, the pressure on the Hullett. But we were on a roll, and fortunate enough for us, we went on to finish 7th that season.
Can I test my memory? I may be making this up, but Under Peter Reid, he had an assistant. Saxton?
Yeah, Bobby Saxton.
Bobby Saxton. Equal character.
Oh, yeah.
Comes from a different part of the country than Peter, but Peter would very much be the front message and Bobby might be a little bit more on the tactical side, maybe?
Yes, yeah, you're dead right.
Both kind of like very calm, very few swear words.
We're talking about the same people here.
I could be wrong in that case. Okay, let me just revert that. You wouldn't want to take a bad performance into either of them, right?
Oh, no. No.
When you, as a team, make your debut in the Premier League, having been promoted with such style and winning the title in a championship, getting a medal for it, a nice achievement, if you're talking about Sunderland legends. You go to Chelsea and you get handed a right sore one. Did you have some sort of team debriefing out on the pitch afterwards, or some sort of team meeting with Bobby?
Straight after.
I wondered if I'd invented that.
He kept everyone out. We didn't even go in. Took us out on, well, we stayed out.
Stamford Bridge?
Yeah, Stamford Bridge. We stayed out. And we had the team meeting there. And it wasn't really a dressing down. It was more of a welcome to the Premier League. This is the standard that you're going to be up against. Not every week, because not everyone's as good as Chelsea. But don't let it derail what you did last season. Don't let it derail your momentum that brought you into this campaign, this league, this season. Yes, you've been given a lesson today, but you've got to learn from this lesson. And we've got to learn quick, because we've got a game Tuesday night against Watford. And when Peter Reid and Bobby Saxton talk to you, they've been there, they've seen it, they've done it. So you kind of go, they know what they're talking about.
But it's on the pitch, Kevin.
It is, but it was...
Does that, in the instant when they say stay out, because footballers are people of curiosity. They don't often like odd things.
Yeah, but
most footballers...
Don't forget, we were in an era then when you did your cool down after a game.
Right.
So, you know, you've seen it over... Not many teams do it now. You stay out. The science has been done. It's either it's good for you, it's not good for you, it's good for you, it's not good for you. But at that time, we used to do cool downs because we had a game. We never came in on a Sunday, so we'd have a game Tuesday. So we'd have a little jog after the game. So it wasn't like giddy now. You're all. It was more of we all congregate together for the fitness coach to say, right, this is what we're going to do. We'll have a jog round. But Bobby, I thought it was good management because they've come over instead of waiting until we got into the dressing room. They've got it off their chest straight away. It's done, it's dusted. This is what we need to do to win on Tuesday night. As soon as we get back on that team bus, we're focused on Watford. So he could have let us dwell on it, running around, everyone having a moan at each other, then get in the dressing room. But he dealt with it there and then. It wasn't like the crowd are going, oh, they're getting told off, they're getting
blocked.
So it was, as I say, you know, Pete and Bobby got so much experience between them, we respected it.
I kind of ask you, you've painted a different picture, but I kind of ask because... I think what I've learned is that in football, either in football or in journalism or fans, we're very hypocritical.
Yeah.
Because A is good. That's really good. And then you do A again in a different situation. Yeah. Suddenly it's bad.
Yeah.
That's so stupid. So, for example, I don't want to hone in on this, but Phil Brown does that at halftime at Hull.
I was just going to say
so
that,
famously.
Yeah.
And I've never spoken to a Hull player from that day, so I don't know if they thought it was stupid or embarrassing or whatever. But automatically it was painted as being eccentric and idiosyncratic and stupid and bad. And it's not identical to what happened at Chelsea. But all the same, it was just painted as, well, that's evidence that he's lost the plot or something like that. When human psychology is different from that. You found that a positive at Chelsea, despite these are all very sore from the 4-0. And maybe a wee bit worried too, I don't know.
Oh, worried, yeah. 100. As on a personal note, I was, because I don't think I touched the ball that day.
Is that bad?
So straight away I'm thinking... God, this is going to be tough. And I already had the critics out there. And Rodney Marsh famously said that I wouldn't get more than 5 goals in the Premier League that season. So straight away, you kind of... Although I had confidence in myself, you know, there's the doubters out there about one individual players being one myself, the team that we wouldn't, you know, get so many points. So, yeah, you get crushed 4-0. It's, of course, there's going to be a bit of worry about it. But I felt the way Peter and Bobby dealt with it on the pitch... at a time when we perhaps needed it. And it worked because we won on the Tuesday night and then we went on a hell of a run after that.
When you get them back again halfway through the season and you give them 4...
Yeah, we give them... For me, that was the best game of football I've ever played in.
Seriously?
Ever. Yeah, it was just incredible. And, you know, you go on about us being a bit embarrassed. Well, I say we got embarrassed, we were hurt. We spoke about it before the game, about the first day of the season. We owe this lot one. And, you know, at the time we were full of confidence, we were playing well, we were doing fine in the league. And that day was just one of those days. And you would have been to a football match where one team, everything they do, everything they touch just comes off. And we find ourselves 4-0 up at half-time. It was incredible.
You were on them. You pressed them.
Pressed them, didn't give them a minute's peace. And you could actually see, once we started pressing them, we got at them from the first whistle.
Who are we talking about? Desailly,
yeah, Leboeuf.
World Cup winners.
Poirier, Zola, Dennis Wise. You know, they were all in
a
there.
A ferocious team as well, as a talented team.
Yeah, but we just, once you could see in their eyes as well, perhaps what they saw a little bit, well, they saw a lot in our eyes on the first day, a little bit of fear.
You could see.
And you could just see, hold on a minute, these ain't up for it today. So it was an incredible performance.
Thank you for joining us for season 2018-19. We've got huge creative plans for the months ahead, but we do need your help to make them happen. Please go right now to patreon.com/Graham Hunter and become a social, become a paying member, and get an extra big interview every month plus loads of bonus content. Last season, socios listened to 9 exclusive big interviews, including Rafa van der Vaart, Troy Deeney, Roberto Di Matteo, and loads of me talking about football. The Premier League, the Champions League, Spanish football. I'm sure they enjoyed it and you will too. Support us, join us. Thank you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.